Hi, welcome to Perspectives on Faith. My name is Metin Tekin. This week, we are at a Rumi conference at George Washington University, Washington, D.C. We have with us two scholars, Dr. Muhammad Faghfuri, Department of Religion, George Washington University, Washington, D.C., and Dr. Mehdi Amin Rezavi, Department of Philosophy of Religion, University of Mary Washington, Fredericksburg, Virginia. I would like to welcome both of you gentlemen to our program here.
Thank you.
Dr. Rezavi, what is the relevance of Rumi in the contemporary world?
Thank you very much for inviting us and having this conversation. Rumi is very pertinent and important to the modern world for a number of reasons, the least of which is that there is a revival of Sufism in general and Rumi in particular. I think part of it has to do with the fact that fundamentalism is so prevalent in parts of the Islamic world. The sort of more orthodox approach to Islam has created the kind of ambience, the kind of environment that many people are trying to look for alternative interpretations, interpretations that, for example, Rumi is a very good representative of that. The spirit of tolerance, the spirit of inclusiveness, the spirit of acceptance of the other people is so central to Rumi's teachings. And so I think in the beginnings of the 21st century, when we see so much intolerance, not only in the Islamic world, but also in the European world, of people who don't tolerate others because they're different, maybe their religion, maybe color, maybe ethnicity, from Bosnia to, you know, Afghanistan and other parts of the world, I think Rumi is a breath of fresh air. He brings to us a different kind of approach and perspective to looking at the world. We can all coexist, we can all love each other, and we can all respect each other. I think that's one of the general salient features of Rumi's thought.
I would like to pose the same question to you, Dr. Faghfuri. What's the relevance of Rumi in the contemporary world?
Well, we have to go a little back in history. From the time of French Revolution, when new ideas came into being, one of the very strong ideas that was introduced was separation of religion from politics and from other aspects of life, emphasis on freedom of religion. But unfortunately, in the course of a century and a half, freedom of religion, in a sense, was translated into freedom from religion. And this, in a way, caused a very big vacuum, a spiritual vacuum, particularly in the West. And those of us in the Muslim world who were trying to follow the West or imitate the West were not affected as much as the people of the West, but nonetheless, living in the West right now, we very strongly feel that gap. And that is why, despite many other problems in the realm of politics and confrontations between groups from the East, groups from the West, from Muslim world and non-Muslim world, the appeal of Rumi is very strong precisely because it answers to this question. It fills the gap that was created a century and a half ago. And that's why people can relate to Rumi and can understand his message, particularly because the message is very relevant to today. Very rarely, in the name of, say, freedom and democracy, we have been so intolerant of each other, the West and the East. And that's why Rumi provides an alternative for this attitude, which is very much prevalent today.
So you're saying that because of our culture, based on materialism in one sense, another sense fundamentalism, people are impoverished and they want to fill in that vacuum.
You might say that. There are so many contradictory forces at work, which in a sense contribute to the popularity of views and ideas like Rumi and individuals like Rumi. On the one hand, you have the extremist religions religious movements, whether you're talking about Islamic fundamentalism or you're talking about Christian fundamentalism or Jewish fundamentalism and many others, and some also in the process of emergence. And on the other hand, you have totally disregard to religion and spirituality from other segments of the Western society. These two and three conflicting forces are, in fact, very much in clash with each other, and Rumi presents a very, very interesting, workable, and acceptable alternative to all of these groups, or for all those people who are in search of an alternative to these extreme currents.
Dr. Amin Rizavi, why the interest in Rumi? Why not some other religious or spiritual person from another tradition, maybe?
Right, that's a very good question. You know, Rumi, of course, has written so much and has commented on so many issues, but rightly so, he's come to be known and identified as the poet of love. I mean, the centerpiece of his poetry rests on the concept of love. And at no time in human history has the modern world been searching more for love than the contemporary impoverished materialistic world, especially in the West. What we have is a world in which not only wars have become a fact of life, but people have distanced themselves from real humans out there. Their contact with others is through the internet, through television, through the media. Often in the West, as you know, people don't know who their neighbors are. Families are disintegrated. The extended family system has disintegrated. So essentially, you have a world in which people have this great thirst for love. And Rumi addresses that issue so beautifully in so many different ways. I'm not sure if his message of love is always understood properly, and that's something else that we will hopefully discuss. But I think the heart and soul of Rumi's message, which is the concept of love, is so timely. The modern world craves for that, and it is as if they found this gold mine all in one place.
What does Rumi say about getting in touch with other human beings?
Well, he sees humanity as one body. And different parts of it as different limbs, different parts of a human body. He does not separate it at a time when individualism is so prevalent. There is this big, huge ego at the center of so many societies where people want to separate themselves based on race and culture and ethnicity and language and so many things. Rumi says we all are one. We have the same origin. We are essentially a united whole, and I think that message is very heartwarming and refreshing.
What were some of the examples of Rumi for our contemporary world in terms of interfaith dialogue? Did he have dialogue? Did he establish dialogue with other members, other faith adherents?
Well, if you read the Divan of Kabir, of Rumi, or Masnavi, there is hardly any piece of poetry that he does not address the very same question that you address right now. And since all of them come from God, they all ultimately reflect one reality. Somebody made an example of revelation of God's message in general, like a waterfall which gushes forth from the top of a mountain. And once it comes down, it is divided into several different rivers and streams. All of these rivers and streams are still from the same source, which is water, but each in its own forms. And this is how, in a way, Rumi sees different religions. And that's why he does not really differentiate them in the realm of meaning. Although in the realm of form, like those streams and rivers that each go, one goes through the mountain, one goes through the valleys and so on, and takes different forms. They are very different, and they must be very different, and that's what God wants. Nonetheless, what Rumi emphasizes is the ultimate reality, ultimate one source of all these religions. And perhaps this is one of the reasons that makes his message very appealing today. Many Muslim saints, philosophers, Sufis have written on this issue. There are many stories in Masnavi, for example, in a conversation between Sayyidina Musa, Moses, and God. One of the most, Moses as bringer of law, as Jewish, bringer of Jewish law, in a sense, has a very powerful, very strong personality in general, and also reflected in Masnavi. There are many stories that reflect this. One of them being when Rumi talks about the story of Moses and the shepherd. I don't know, most of us might have heard that. For those of us who know Persian, maybe I should recite a couple lines of that.
Please do so.
He says, "Did Musa yek shabani ra berah ku kami hami gofte elahu ay khoda to kujayi ta shabam man chakrat charoqat duzam konam shan sarat dastakat busam be malam payekat waqt khab bayad berubam jayekat." And all the way to the end, meaning, the shepherd, being a simple man, was talking to God and saying that, in a way, thinking God in human terms. And he was saying that, "Where are you that so that I would become your slave? I would comb your hair and I would wash your feet when you come home at night. When it's time to go to sleep, I would spread your bed." And then Moses, being a prophet of logic and reason and law, became very upset hearing this and said, "Go and ask God for forgiveness." Because before even becoming a Muslim, in the general sense of the term, before being a Muslim, meaning being in submission to God, you became an infidel. And obviously, then Rumi takes the story further into the desert, saying that the shepherd became very upset, very sad, very heartbroken. And he was going in the desert and crying and talking to God and asking for forgiveness. Suddenly a revelation comes to Moses, addressing him, "To baraye vas kardan amedi, ne baraye fas kardan amedi, bande ma ra chara kardi juda?" Meaning that, "Oh Moses, you are a prophet. You came to connect people to us. You did not come to disconnect people from to us. So go and find this man and tell him that his prayer is accepted." So Moses goes and finds the man, and at the end tells him, "Heech adabi tartibi maju harche mikhahad dele tangat begu." Don't feel limited, restricted by any manner or etiquette. Say whatever your broken heart wants, because God listens. So messages like this, many, many stories regarding Moses, regarding Jesus Christ, regarding beauty of Joseph and chastity of Joseph. There are many, many occasions in Masnavi and Divan that talk about these, of course, in addition to many profound metaphysical questions. And these are what makes Rumi and his writings and his poetry so appealing to the people. Perhaps 50 years ago, if you asked somebody, except very few scholars, that there are a lot of Muslim saints and Sufis and poets who have talked about Jesus Christ, Western population would have found it difficult to believe that. Nowadays, each piece of his writings and poetry about Christ and about Moses and about Joseph is readily available in many different languages.
So very brief.
Yes. Just you like to add? Please.
Yeah, just something.
What I have.
I observed. The message that comes out of that is so beautiful. Let the God of Moses be the God of Moses, and let the God of a shepherd be the God of a shepherd. And that's a very, very powerful message to a world which, on one hand, thrives on multiplicity, right? Different people worship God differently. Different people have different spirituality. And so compare that to the message of, let's say, fundamentalism, very strict forms of fundamentalism, which wants everybody to basically adhere to the same way of worshiping. And so that's what I think we both have been discussing, and that's why Rumi's message is so powerful and so timely. On one hand, we have a world which is becoming closer and closer, the concept of global village. And Rumi's message of unity, right, is very much in tune with the contemporary world. On the other hand, he allows room for people's individualism, their individual ways of worshiping God, the way different people relate to spirituality, to flourish, and he doesn't stop that either. And so unity and multiplicity, it's a very, very healthy relationship which we see in Rumi.
What is the status of Rumi in the world, in the West, the contemporary world? Also, studies of Rumi, Rumi studies, presently.
Right. Well, his status is both positive and negative. And as you probably know, Rumi is the best-selling poet in America and has been for the last several years. And there's something very positive and something slightly negative about that. Let me start with the negative one, because he is known as the poet of love, the love poet. But not everyone understands love in the same way that Rumi did. There is a very superficial understanding of it. I mean, we have people in Hollywood from Madonna who has translated or adopted translations of Rumi, has turned it into some pop music, and when you listen to it, the way she and some of the other pop icons are using the concept of love is very, very shallow, very superficial. It's not what Rumi had in mind. That profound, mystical, existential love is very different. So in that sense, if you walk into just about any bookstore in America, you will see at least a dozen or two books on Rumi. There are numerous translations of Rumi, many, many of which are not scholarly or not accurate. There are free translations of him. People who either know very little Persian or not at all, but someone else translates it for them, they have all rendered different translations of Rumi. So in that sense, there is a good deal of misunderstanding about Rumi. But I don't want to be too pessimistic, because there's also a great deal of interest, genuine interest in Rumi. Dr. Fakhfuri will probably address translations of him and so on. But there's also a genuine search and interest in the true, authentic meaning of some of the concepts that Rumi is talking about. There are commentaries on him. There are serious scholars. Rumi's translations, finer translations, are now being adopted as textbooks in colleges and universities. He's, you know, virtually becoming a household name. In some of my classes, I use examples as poets and so on. And when I say Rumi, lots of students says, "Oh yes, I've read him." And so that, in that sense, there is something very positive to be said about that. To summarize that, the status of Rumi in America, in the West, is a living poet. He is for us. He is being studied. There's a great deal of interest, and I think with places like Rumi Forum and these kinds of conferences, that generates even more interest in him.
Even the negative aspect of which you noted, it seems to be a positive. People are groping. They're trying to find.
Right.
So it's not malicious in a sense.
But that's true. It's innocent. Right.
The intent is there. It's just limited understanding.
That's
of the tradition, of the vocabulary.
Very much so.
We have to take a break here, so please stay with us. We'll be back shortly. Thank you for staying with us. We are back discussing Rumi with Dr. Faghfuri and Amin Rezavi. Dr. Faghfuri, what has been the interest of university students to the message of Rumi?
Well, first of all, a few years ago, perhaps, there were a handful of courses in different American universities that I'm, you know, a little bit familiar with, that addressed in part of a course life and poetry of Rumi. There are right now, despite the fact that many Persian language programs have been dropped from universities for other reasons up until very recently, and most Persian language programs that are available now do not address literature, poetry, and spirituality. Nonetheless, the interest on American universities on Islamic spirituality and Sufism in general, and particularly Rumi, has been so strong and rising every day. There are on many campuses now not only courses on Sufism, which place heavy emphasis on Rumi, include, and also other Sufi poets and writers, but there are courses on Sufi literature, both in Turkish, Persian, and also in Arabic, that deal with writings and poetry of Rumi, but not only as a literary heritage, but as a heritage of Islamic spirituality and rich thought in the context of Islamic civilization. The interest that the students show is tremendous. We have had a rising demand in the number of students who are interested in learning Persian. 20 years ago, nobody perhaps on this campus spoke Persian or had any interest in learning Persian. The same goes for Turkish, the same goes for Arabic, and none of these are would have happened had it not been for the rich and very spiritually fulfilling the message of Rumi and other Muslim writers and Sufis like him.
Dr. Amin Rezavi, what has been your experience, students' response?
There's a great deal of interest, both on college campuses and outside of it, in Sufism. So I would divide that into what I would call academic Sufism and practical Sufism. On college campuses, due to the great interest in non-Western literature, non-Western schools of thought, which university colleges and universities have been promoting in the last decade or so, there's a great deal of interest in Sufism in general and Rumi in particular. And some of these students who become familiar with the more theoretical aspect of Sufism, what I call academic Sufism, and then seek spiritual guidance outside of it, and they join Sufi centers, and it's a very, very thriving community.
What kind of activities do they have at these centers, the Sufi centers?
It's very much traditional traditional Sufi practices, depending, you know, as you know, it changes from order to order. Some are more lively, let's say, for the lack of a better term, like Mevlana Sufism. There's always chanting, praying, meditation, and then spiritual novices receive instructions from Sufi masters. Dr. Faghfuri might be able to shed more light on that, but that's generally speaking how it works.
Dr. Faghfuri, would you like to add anything to what Dr. Rezavi mentioned?
Well, the interest, as Dr. Amin Rezavi said, has been growing very fast on Sufism, which is good in many ways, but also has its own minuses as well. What Rumi represents is genuine Islamic spirituality, and it's a very serious business. The worst thing and the most dangerous thing to do, whether consciously or unconsciously, is in a sense to commercialize what Rumi says. Unfortunately, many have done this and have reaped the benefit, financial benefits of that, and I don't want to name any particular person or group. Nonetheless, this danger also always exists. But there are some groups who, while one cannot doubt the individual sincerity of people associated with them, probably take, in a sense, take the kernel of Sufism and what Rumi says, throw it away and just keep the shell. And they are very much content with the appearance or feeling of affiliation with a center called a Sufi center. And these are very dangerous things. And I don't think, and they are inevitable, of course, but they are not going to last or have any long-lasting effect. There are, however, some centers which obviously with great sincerity and seriousness follow what Rumi says and what Rumi did, what other Sufi masters taught in the course of 10 centuries or so. And those are the ones who usually are open to their own members only, and rightly so. And therefore, it varies from order to order, but also non-initiates, I should say, do not see or observe much of their activities, and this is what it has always been in genuine Sufi orders. As up until perhaps 100 years ago, non-initiates were not allowed to enter into the ceremonies and invocation sessions of the Rumi order either. So there are many, many groups that are now mushrooming, so to speak, and one has to be aware of that. One, while one has to appreciate their quest for truth and for love and for God, ultimately, nonetheless, one has to be watching them very carefully as far as their activities are concerned, and do not confuse the activities of some of these groups with genuine Sufism that Rumi represented.
Just to comment on that a bit, again, I keep going back to history. Much of Sufism came to America in the 60s. In fact, when there was this great influx of so-called Eastern wisdom, Hinduism, Buddhism, Sufism, and all that. And unfortunately, part of the reason was the peace movement, what was called the hippie movement. And so spirituality, which came to America in the 60s, was an anti-war, anti-violence, pacifist, anything goes movement. And so there was a great deal of touchy-feely matters there, and people wanted to express their freedom and so on. And as Dr. Faghfouri mentioned, true Sufism is a discipline, almost like martial arts. There's a big difference between genuine martial art and street fight, right? If you want to learn martial art, it takes years and years and years of practice. So the legacy of the 60s sort of lingered on in a certain form after the 60s went away. There were some notions of Sufism as kind of a, you know, called, for the lack of a better term, where this spirituality was adopted, but Islam was not necessarily. So it became a kind of a generic spirituality almost. In the last two decades or so, because of the great influx of Muslims to America from all over the Islamic world, there is a return to the more traditional, orthodox, genuine discipline that comes with this spirituality. So a number of people who are interested, they read Rumi, he talks about love and freedom and beauty and all that, and then they pursue that. They come into a Sufi center, and right at the gate, they say, wait, there's a discipline. Are you willing to submit to this? And that's where the very serious ones stay, and those who are not willing, they sort of fade, go by the wayside.
Now, mine's going to be a little critical here, but Rumi is known to have called everyone, come to me. So even those who are not disciplined, aren't they invited as well, one might ask?
Yes, he says, come, and if you have failed, come back 1,000 times. But each time you come, you have to take a test.
Interesting.
As long as you have the intention, as long as you have the intention of coming back, no one can stop you. And Rumi makes it very clear. But once you come, Rumi, more than anybody else perhaps, draws our attention to the seriousness of this undertaking.
As we all know, UNESCO has declared 2007 to be the year of Rumi. What are they trying to say by that?
Well, I think it's a very noble undertaking that UNESCO has started, more so than in the past, to recognize the rich legacy of the civilization of that part of the world we call the Islamic world. And this includes a variety of civilizations from Persian, Turkish, Arab, Hindu, Indian subcontinent, and so on. And I just hope and pray it doesn't stop here. Declaring a year as the year of Rumi is a very good idea. But what is going to be done in this 1 year is even more noble and more important. I hope it is not just limited to a number of conferences here and there and some intellectuals, perhaps, who know Rumi only through books, and which Rumi very much opposes, that kind of knowledge. Come and give a couple papers here and there, and then that becomes the year of Rumi. This is not really what Rumi wants to see as a year called by his name. He wants to see his message spread, and spread correctly. He's not in rush to spread it all over the world and convert everybody else to what he thinks. But he wants this to be done very, very carefully and very, very selectively and seriously, too.
Dr. Amin Razavi, I would like to direct the same question to you as well.
Yes. I agree with my colleague, it's a great honor that UNESCO has decided to choose a representative of the Islamic civilization, and certainly the cream of the crop, the one of the best of the best. And I think it's not only important in substance, because there is so much that Rumi offers to human civilization, but also symbolically. At a time when intolerance, when fundamentalism, when this very, very intolerant mindset begins to take shape, to take hold in so many of the lands in our part of the world, Rumi, as the symbol of tolerance, inclusiveness, is being honored. And that's certainly, UNESCO is to be complimented. The message of Rumi is universal, and I cannot think of anyone else who would be more appropriate for the universe to respect than Rumi.
Our program is drawing to a close. Last question would be, what are the roles and contributions of groups like the Rumi Forum to the legacy of Rumi?
Well, first of all, I should commend you for, establishing this forum a few years back, and all the activities that the forum has been performing in the last 5-6 years, especially in bringing more and more understanding by contacting different religious groups, different ethnic groups, linguistic groups, and overall trying to get the message of Rumi across, that we are all children of one God. We are all children of, especially in the context of Abrahamic religions, we are all children of Abraham. This is one of the very important achievements of groups or forums or centers like Rumi Forum. I just hope it doesn't stop there. I just hope it goes far deeper and far more extensive. And reaches as many people as it can, but also Rumi is not a one-dimensional person whose message is only tolerance and love. Rumi is an extremely pious, extremely orthodox Muslim
philosopher, thinker, metaphysician, and saint. These aspects of Rumi should also be very much introduced by centers like Rumi Forum, because otherwise Rumi is introduced in a very distorted way, as if he was a man who was easy with his own religion. He didn't care about other religions. He was, in a sense, a free thinker who had no relation with revelation at all. And this is the wrongest picture one can give, not only of Rumi, of any other figure in Islamic spirituality. If this is understood and presented to the people, of course, not with the intention of converting everybody to Rumi's thought, but waking up everybody to the tradition that he or she lives in, precisely what Rumi hoped to do and did in his own lifetime. That's why when he died, we read in history that the entire city and surroundings, including Armenian, Jews, Muslims, Persian, Turks, Arabs, all participated not only in his funeral, but had their own session for commemorating his death. This is the kind of message that Rumi wants to. In a sense, Rumi doesn't want to convert everybody to Islam. He wants to wake up everybody to the reality of his own tradition, his own religion. And I think for this purpose, centers and groups and associations like Rumi Forum can play a very, very important role. And I hope that they would play that important role.
Dr. Izzati?
Yes, our civilization needs bridge builders at a time when divisions are so deep, and there are those who propose and advocate clash of civilizations. I think dialogue among civilizations is the most imperative and most important task before us. And people like Rumi are bridge builders, and places like Rumi Forum their responsibility and their agenda is incredibly important. They bring people together. They provide a forum where different religions can come together. Interfaith dialogue on the most profound level takes place in this setting. What we have witnessed in the last day and a half has been none other than that. I was looking around in the audience, and there was a Franciscan monk, and there were clergies, and there were Jews and Muslims, Sunnis, Shiites, Ismailis. They all sat in the same room under the same roof, and Rumi became a focal point, the person who brought everyone together. And I think that is so significant, so important, that it ought to continue. So I also compliment the Rumi Forum for having achieved this task, and I hope to see this continue for years to come.
Dr. Farpouri, Dr. Emin Rezavi, I would like to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's it for now. Please join us next week for another exciting show on Perspectives on Faith. I am Metin Teke. Goodbye.